Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to be updating matters German. Although the United States certainly gets most of the press coverage in the United States, in fact, I think that the future is going to be not only German, but Nazi. And that will seem incredible to some listeners. The documentation is there, and they can access the tapes from Spitfire. We have a lot of information to download, so I'm going to get right to it. If some of the supplemental discussion is not satisfactory for listeners, particularly newer listeners, you have my sympathy and understanding. I can only encourage you to get a hold of previous tapes and documentary sources that contain the documentation for what I'm talking about. One of the major focal points of the broadcast for the last several years is something that is completely unknown to most people and something that I feel is going to prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet, namely the remarkable and deadly Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Research credit on the following two articles goes to Peter Manning, the son of Paul Manning, the heroic journalist who is the source for the information about the Bormann Organization. Paul Manning, by the way, was a colleague of Edward R. Murrow's and Walter Cronkite's for CBS News covering World War II, which he did from the invasion of France and the Blitz on London all the way through the war in Western Europe. In order to cover the air raids over Germany, he had to train as a B-17 waste gunner because the planes couldn't afford to carry extra weight. He was credited with shooting down an ME-109 while serving as a waste gunner. And then when he went to cover the war in the Pacific, he trained as a nose gunner for a B-29. He was a very heroic journalist. And his work stands as a landmark for what journalists should strive for but don't. He wrote a remarkable book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart Press, copyright 1981. And that book, in many ways, I believe perhaps the most important book ever written, yet that book wound up deep-sixing Paul Manning's journalistic career. The publisher of Lyle Stewart had his legs broken the week of publication, and later Paul Manning's son Jerry was murdered, apparently in retribution for Paul Manning's efforts. And again, a tip of the hat to Peter Manning, the late Paul Manning's son, who sent me these two articles. These articles are from a now-defunct publication called The News World, which was an attempt by the Unification Church to enter the journalistic world of New York City. Unification Church is an institution that I condemn thoroughly. It is a fascist institution and one that whose genesis goes back to the patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies that brought fascism to Japan. Talked about the Moon Organization and, among other programs, RFA Program Number 7, and also in a couple of miscellaneous For the Record segments entitled George Bush and the Moon Organization. Nonetheless, though, the Moon Organization was entering American journalism in the early 1980s, and although the News World publication did not make it, in an attempt to garner kudos for the publication in order to launch it, the Moon Organization, or the News World, a Moon publication, actually did publish some good articles which no one else would publish, and one of the pairs of articles that they published were the following two articles by Paul Manning. And again, a kudos, or a caveat, I should say, I do not but in any way hold a brief for the Moon Organization, but no one else would publish these two articles. And these articles are the story of how Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning's book, was deep-sixed in the publishing industry as a result of pressure from the remarkable and deadly Bormann Organization. The following is from the News World of Tuesday, August 24th of 1982. This article is entitled, Publishing Conspiracy to Deep Six Bormann Book. I'm going to read the article, which is self-explanatory, and for those not familiar with the Bormann Organization, an explanation is evident in the context of this story. The introduction to the story begins, Journalist Paul Manning thought he had a bestseller when he tracked down Hitler's chief deputy, Martin Bormann, in Argentina. Much to his surprise, however, several publishers turned down the manuscript of his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, after lengthy perusals. The reason, he discovered, was that Bormann's Nazi-funded industrial empire is today, and bear in mind this is 1982, powerful enough to reach into New York's publisher's row and threaten any firm brave enough to print a story that endangers its interests. The following is the first of a two-part series on Paul Manning's fight to publish the facts of Martin Bormann's existence. Part 2 will appear tomorrow, and part of Part 2 will be read into the record in a minute. The main body of the article reads, Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler's wartime deputy Führer and legal successor as leader of the worldwide Nazi Party after the fall of Berlin, is alive and well and living in luxury on his 200,000-acre Argentine ranch. From it, he directs a global business empire. He made it safely out of Germany to Buenos Aires in 1947, following the first Nuremberg trials at which he and 12 other Nazi leaders were convicted as war criminals. 10 were hanged in the gymnasium of Nuremberg, or the gymnasium of Nuremberg prison. Only Hermann Göring and Bormann evaded this fate. Göring took his own life by means of a cyanide capsule that had been smuggled into him. Bormann, convicted actually in absentia, for he had been in hiding ever since the night of May 12, 1945, made his way to South America, where he assumed command over the enormous hoard of liquid assets he had sent out of Germany during the last years of World War II by means of the 750 corporations he had established in neutral nations to guard and to increase this German treasure. Note the next paragraph, because it's part of the great significance of the Bormann organization. Month by month, new firms are being launched across the globe from monies generated by that core of 750 companies originally set up in Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Turkey, and Argentina. When I tracked Martin Bormann to South America and then wrote a book about it, I thought it would be easy to get it published and I envisioned a worldwide bestseller. But this was not to be. I had not anticipated the resistance to the Bormann saga by established wealth and power. Bormann's escape and his subsequent existence in Argentina was West Germany's best-kept secret until I opened it up with my book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It told too much about powerful people who had collaborated, and still do, with Bormann and his organization in Western Europe, the United States, and South America. My book ran counter to their personal interests. Too many still do business according to Winston Churchill's admonition to his war cabinet in 1943, quote, "Truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies," unquote. Those I approached for information, whether in government, industry, or banking, whether in Washington or in foreign capitals, were more interested in protecting their secrets and the flanks of their peers than in any revelations for the sake of history. They see the war is still on, and they erected a bramble of lies that I had to cut through to reach the truth. The working title for my book had been Conspiracy of Silence, because it described exactly what I had been up against. The firm that finally had the courage to publish my book, Lyle Stewart, thought Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, would be more commercial, and perhaps it is. But no title would have placated the opposition to me. Publication of my book is quietly forbidden in West Germany, just as it is in England. Bear in mind, this was written, this article is from August 24th, 1982. The two Germanys were still divided at that point. Continuing, the intensity of this opposition was reflected in the decree by the West German government against Quick magazine, a West German news weekly. Quick had sent a 5-reporter team to South America to get material for a magazine series on Bormann's presence and the scope of his operation in Argentina, and on his close ties to German industry and finance and political leadership in Bonn. According to Ladislas Farrago, author of Aftermath, which placed Bormann in Argentina, who gave me these facts before his death, they got the story but never published it. The West German equivalent of the FBI descended on the publishers of Quick and warned them that to print this story, quote, would not be in the national interest, unquote. If this warning were violated, the magazine would be closed down, and the 5 reporters and their editors would be imprisoned. The decision against Quick had been made at the highest levels of the Federal Republic of Germany, and obviously the order had come right from the presidential palace in Bonn, Farrago said. The West German president, Karl Carstens, was quite understandably disturbed over the prospect of the Quick revelations. He had been a Nazi Party member during the Third Reich, just as had his predecessor, Walter Scheel. This should not necessarily have interfered with the U.S. publication of my Bormann book, but it did. One noted New York publisher and his editorial staff rejected my manuscript and explained in a letter to me, quote, "After a lot of talk and a lot of meetings, we have decided to step aside. But there is no question in my mind that you have transformed your idea into a book and a potentially saleable one, and I wish you luck with it," unquote. Later, I learned that this publisher had strong business connections with West German publishing companies and obviously thought it imprudent to publish material on West Germany's verboten list. Another renowned New York publisher contracted for my book, and all was going along merrily until my contract was abruptly and without explanation voided. The decision to back off from publishing my Martin Bormann book was made not by the editor-in-chief who wanted the book, but by business executives at the highest level of the publishing house's holding company, who had received whispered warnings against it from Washington. Another New York publisher entered into a contract with me, complete with two advance payments, indicating satisfaction with my book, then, assuring me he was making progress with it, kept it locked away for a full year until the contract ran out. I then took the book to Lyle Stewart, who had the guts to publish it. But several years had gone by thanks to the others who had followed warnings to keep it away from the reading public. I learned that one of the publishers who had let me down was owned completely by Dutch-German shareholders who were obliged to comply with any request from Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of Fritz Thiessen, the original financial sponsor of Adolf Hitler. The Count today controls the Thiessen Steel Group, West Germany's largest from Buenos Aires, and is a close friend of Martin Bormann. I made the mistake of writing to him at his residence in Buenos Aires, asking for an interview and giving him the name of my publisher at that time. It took no time at all for him to make a telephone call from his residence to Dusseldorf and issue the firm suggestion to the Dutch-German owners of this New York publishing house that the Paul Manning biography of Martin Bormann be put aside. By the way, interrupting, in FTR's 122 and 123, I went into the German corporate control of American publishing. The apparently Odessa-linked firm von Holtzbrinck, one of whose primary personnel, Michael Naumann, is now the German cultural minister, and the even more important Bertelsmann company dominate American publishing. Bertelsmann's founder, Heinrich Mohn, had been in the SS in World War II. His son had been with the elite Hermann Göring Division, that's Reinhard Mohn, and one of Reinhard Mohn's proteges is the head of Thiessen AG. And with Thiessen AG's major connections to the Bormann Group, I noted that in those two pairs of half-hour segments, again, FTRs 122 and 123, and observing the role not only of Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, but also other corporations connected to West German or German industry, and through that, inevitably, to the Bormann Organization, effected the deep sixing of the Martin Bormann book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Some of my concerns about the German corporate control of American publishing could be exemplified with this particular model, because I think it presents a model for the censoring of American academia and American journalism, even beyond the level to which it is already censored, and that is plenty damn censored. And again, this is one of the many reasons why I think the Bormann Organization is going to prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet, and I believe that the future will be Hitler's, so to speak, through the Bormann Organization. Perhaps I'm wrong, and again, as I've said before, rather than criticize me for my analysis, and I strive for accurate analysis, if you don't like that analysis, get out and try to change the future. I'm interested here in accurate analysis. Continuing. Then there was a far-reaching but hidden clout exercise by major German multinationals, mentioning to their U.S. corporations and corporate friends that it would be appreciated if Paul Manning's book never appeared. Those suggestions were, so to speak, passed along publishing and Agent Row in New York City. When the book did appear, it was placed in low profile in most bookstores. Yet it became a steady seller in bookstores on Fifth Avenue and across the country. But at no time was it reviewed by the New York Times. It was as if the word had gone out from certain people in Washington that this book was to be deep-sixed by being ignored. I could understand the position of the New York Times. They have been susceptible to official Washington influence ever since the late Arthur Hayes Sulzberger agreed to let CIA agents become Times stringers at various overseas posts, just as did other New York publications like Time and Life, which also declined to review my book, as did Newsweek magazine. That, again, from News World, a now-defunct publication, which was an attempt by the Moon Organization to launch a New York publishing arm, rather like the Washington Times, which succeeded. And again, I have no use for the Moon Organization. I've spoken about it frequently. It is fascist. Nonetheless, no other publication would publish Paul Manning's work, Paul Manning's articles, and I think this is a very, very, very important pair of articles. The second of these articles appeared in the News World of Wednesday, August 25th of 1982. And again, these were sent to me by Peter Manning, Paul Manning's son. This article reads, after an introduction, From my prime connections to the Borman Organization, I learned that certain high officials within the U.S. State Department had assisted in the flight of Martin Borman and his elite SS leadership from Germany to South America after World War II. One German, who himself had provided Borman with a safe house for 10 days following the Reichsleiter's escape from the Führer bunker on May 1st and 2nd, 1945, and had subsequently traveled to South America to work for Borman there, told me that the Borman leadership are concerned that worldwide publicity by me of the Borman story would reveal the fact that U.S. Embassy, consular, and secret intelligence agents high in the U.S. State Department had helped Borman and the SS leadership reach havens in South America. But the biggest problem I have encountered in winning public acceptance of Martin Borman, Nazi in exile, has been the artful and unremitting campaign of disinformation waged by General Heinrich Müller, wartime head of the Gestapo. Since 1947, he has acted as chief of security in South America for the Borman Organization. It was he who discredited Ladislaus Farrago, author and journalist. Farrago wrote the Borman story in 1973 for the London Daily Express, the Chicago Tribune Syndicate, and their New York outlet, the Daily News. The facts behind this discreditation should be of interest to editors and reporters everywhere. As his ploy to discredit Farrago while he was tracking Borman in South America, Mueller's agent supplied Farrago with forged documents. When he had gained the author's confidence, he sold him a photograph purporting to be that of Borman and an Argentine secret agent at a Chilean checkpoint. Predictably, the documents and the published photograph received worldwide press attention. Thereupon, Mueller dispatched another agent to the Buenos Aires office of the New York Times. This one revealed that the photograph was not of Borman at all, but was rather of a high school teacher and his companion. He invited the Times man to bring a camera, and they went together to the high school where the teacher and his friend were once again posed against the background identical to that in the original photograph. This second photo was released worldwide by the New York Times, and responsibility for the hoax was laid on Farrago, who was thus discredited all down the line, with most editors naively assuming that Farrago had done the misrepresenting. It was misinformation at its most skillful and sly. But the effects on U.S. journalism and on editors in general was more devastating than on Farrago himself, who was deeply distressed at having been taken in. However, he went on to write the famous General Patton book that made him a fortune. By the way, Farrago also wrote The Game of the Foxes and another book, Burn After Reading. Continuing. American journalism slipped simply because the search for objective truth in this matter had faltered. The whopping lie that Borman had died in Berlin had been orchestrated and sponsored by Willy Brandt and primed from South America by Mueller and successive German governments. So artful were they that the cover-up was accepted as truth by too many American editors who then couldn't square it with my own valid reporting of the true Borman epic. My research and my credentials will stand up alongside of those of almost any editor in the United States. The KGB is expert at disinformation, but Mueller and his organization of spies and manipulators of media are far more skilled and solidly effective. The U.S. spokesman for the Simon Wiesenthal Group calls the Mueller organization the best intelligence outfit in the world today. My background and reputation for accuracy in reporting was disdained after the West German Chancellor staged a 1973 press conference in Frankfurt. At this occasion, there was exhibited a skull found in the Berlin freight yards and proclaimed to be that of Martin Borman, thus proving that the former Reichsleiter was dead and gone and no one should bother looking for him. American editors took this story at face value, but wiser and more experienced editors in Europe knew it to be false. The attempt was termed a whitewash, unquote, by responsible journalists abroad. The London Daily Express named it for what it was, quote, Borman's perpetual passport to freedom, unquote. It is simply a fact that the Israeli Secret Service has never closed its books on Borman. They know he is in South America, but they don't particularly care. He was not one of those responsible for the final solution. That was Himmler's problem, Borman stated, nor do the Americans, the British, the French, or the Russians want him. Indeed, the Allies of World War II can't afford to hunt him down and lay open to public knowledge his activities and achievements. All the above, together with West Germany, owe him too much. In the final year of the war, the U.S. Treasury Department was aware of German looting of Europe and the Third Reich. Orvis A. Schmidt, Director of Foreign Funds Control, even told a U.S. Senate committee on June 25, 1945, that, quote, the Department of State has abundant evidence that the Nazis in anticipation of military defeat, made careful plans to carry on in foreign countries a wide range of activities necessary to support an eventual resurgence of German power. For this purpose, plans were made and carried out in part to transfer sufficient funds and specifically trained personnel to carry on pan-German activities. In anticipation of Allied victory, thousands of IG Farben secrets went underground along with other German resources. Unquote. Today, through bearer bonds representing investments in German, Dutch, Swedish, Swiss, French, Latin American, and U.S. corporations, together with his control of the trust established and turned over to Bormann by the late Hermann Schmitz, who was president and chief executive officer of IG Farben, Bormann and his organization represent the largest accumulation of financial power ever assembled under one control. For example, the four successor firms to Farben, Hoechst, BASF, Bayer, and Casa de Farbenwerke, have grown to be the four largest chemical corporations in the world. Each is more prosperous than the original Farben at its zenith. It is such success, also generated by the 750 corporations established by Bormann in the neutral nations during the last year of World War II, that served as economic bastions for the Federal Republic of Germany. This has made Bormann the man largely responsible for West Germany's post-war recovery. And in the process, individuals in Washington, New York, London, Paris, and Bonn who attached themselves to this figure and his organization became themselves immensely wealthy and certainly do not want waves by an American author and his research. Bormann has, of course, long since read my book at his home in Argentina. The word I got back regarding his reaction, quote, "It is a good book. However, in regard to its contents, you will not receive any great financial profit or success from it," unquote. I know now he was right. I have also learned what a downhold can do to the success of a book. But there are independent editors across the country who have liked and have been impressed by its ring of truth. The West Coast Review of Books gave it a 4-star rating, concluding its review with, "definitely an eye-opener for readers," unquote. The Sunday Press of Atlantic City gave it an excellent review, concluding, "As pages unfold, the reader is more convinced that the entire truths of the final days of World War II have never been told." Manning's book raises many questions, including how many more top Nazis are still living in splendor throughout the world, including America, enjoying their ill-gotten spoils, unquote. The answer to this lies in the discussion reported by Time magazine from Basel, Switzerland, during the period when the United States had a balance of payments crisis. In the headquarters of the World Monetary Fund, it was discovered that there was $15 billion in circulation that should not really exist. Time questioned, quote, "One wonders where that amount of money came from," unquote. It was Bormann Organization funds, part of the entire Reichsbank treasure that had been shifted from Berlin to Switzerland under control of Reichsleiter Martin Bormann. This treasure was only part of the wealth transferred by Bormann to neutral countries in the last months of the war. It is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records under "The Greatest Unsolved Robbery," unquote. And indeed, I think those two articles from the now-defunct publication The News World from August 24th and 5th of 1982 speak for themselves. And again, one of the reasons that I think the Bormann Organization will prove to be the dominant element in human affairs, aside from the fact that the Third Reich actually went underground and it commands a wide variety of elements, ranging from the German National Security Establishment, grown from the Gehlen spy outfit, through the Republican Ethnic Outreach Council, literally an outgrowth of the Third Reich that constitutes an important part of the Republican Party, on through Nazi elements around the world, so-called neo-Nazis. I don't like the term. They're simply Nazis of the next generation. And other elements around the world, all under political control. And beyond that, the Bormann Organization is, as noted in the second of those two articles, the largest accumulation of money power under one control ever amassed in history. And that is something to reckon with. The German control, German corporate control of American publishing, whose significance I noted earlier in this discussion, is something that I view against the background of an obscure but I believe vitally important Nazi tract called Serpent's Walk that I've dealt with before. Serpent's Walk was published in soft cover by National Vanguard Books. That's the publishing arm of the National Alliance, arguably the most important of the domestic Nazi groups, and the publisher, by the way, of the Turner Diaries that many people may be familiar with. Serpent's Walk was authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L. Was published in softcover by National Vanguard Books, copyright 1991. Please note this is a Nazi publisher, so a very strong caveat. National Vanguard Books is at P.O. Box 330, Hillsborough, West Virginia, 24946. Please exercise appropriate caution. The Serpent's Walk book is about a Nazi takeover by the Underground Reich, the descendants of the Third Reich in the mid-21st century, after they buy into the opinion-forming media and infiltrate the U.S. Army. The back cover of the book describes the book as follows. The good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews, but everyone else lost, including millions of GIs who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Note the following few passages. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. And a knowledgeable observer reading this would certainly recognize the Bormann Organization. And inside, in a conversation between two of the central figures in the book, two Nazis named Lessing and Wrench, Lessing is a former mercenary who's being converted, the discussion reads as follows. And Wrench says to him, the SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places. Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dakar, you name it. They realized that the world is heading toward a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates with fingers in more than one pie. Skipping down, we, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. Skipping down, about 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a super corporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly or with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. And as I've said in the past, this book is not, I believe, the novel it purports to be, but rather a manifesto, a blueprint of what is going on and what will go on. We're going to continue with our update on Matters German in the next half-hour segment. That concludes this half-hour. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.